Welcome to the VoxGig Developer Relations Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Roger. I speak to people in the software development community about developer relations, public speaking, and community events. I'm the CEO of VoxGig, a software consultancy that builds DevRel tools. Because we believe in the power of community, we host a monthly virtual online meetup for everyone in developer relations. Check out devrelmeetup.com. And visit voxgig.com to view our work, use our tools, and sign up for our newsletter. Okay. Please sit back and enjoy my fireside chat with today's guest. Today, I am talking to Brian Rinaldi, developer experience engineer at LaunchDarkly. Now, LaunchDarkly, in case you didn't know, was the company that first built a business from feature flags. Now, Brian has the distinction of running both in-person and virtual events and has a unique perspective on both. And we go deep on how to handle both cases. We also talk about the challenges you face when you are building a dev tool, when that dev tool has much deeper features than you would think at first. For example, feature flags. They're not just environment variables. You can do a whole bunch more with them. Finally, Brian is also a leading light of the Jamstack community. And we talk about how communities and the definitions of communities and terms evolve over time. Fascinating stuff. Okay, let's talk to Brian.
Brian, welcome to the Fireside with VoxGig podcast. It is great to have you on today. You're in sunny Florida. I'm in rainy Ireland. I'm just looking at your windows and the lovely sunshine, palm trees. What is it like to live in? It's such a beautiful place.
Oh, you know, I do love it here in Orlando. I mean, you know, I think it's kind of a solid mix of being close to like a lot of culture and city. But I live like minutes from downtown walking. But I have a lake behind me and a huge yard and beautiful oak trees. So
stop.
Yeah. But that being said, it will be, I mean, I don't know the conversion, but it gets like really, really hot in the summers. It's going to be like upper 90s Fahrenheit, which is brutally hot and humid. So, you know, there's a price to pay. We just through the winter and the spring, we're like, this is the best place to live. And then summer comes and
Well, you know what? In Ireland, we say that about summer as well, because there is a Tuesday in July that is literally the best weather.
That Tuesday in July. Okay.
I have a serious question, right? Because I found this when I was traveling and had to work when the temperatures were high or it was humid. Mm-hmm. And I felt that this is a total sideline. We'll get on to DevRel in a minute. I really found that it affected my ability to concentrate when I was coding. I don't know, do you find, like, obviously you work with aircon, right? But I don't know, have you found that when it gets, when the heat goes up, your brain actually gets kind of worse?
Maybe it's a matter of like, I mean, majority of my life here in Florida. So like, yeah, maybe... If that's the case, I've been suffering from it my whole life, so I don't know any different.
Oh, there you go. You got to move north, and you're coding. You're a 10x now, right? You're going to be a 20x if you move to Canada or somewhere, right?
I lived in Wisconsin for 4 years, and then Boston for 12. So I did move up north, but I suppose, you know, God, but it's hard to say because Boston can get humid, and they don't have air conditioning in a lot of places, so the house. Like my home office would get pretty toasty in the summer.
Okay. Anyway,
leaving the weather aside.
I'm just so jealous of your weather. That's all. Okay. So Brian, let's start with the simple, the basic stuff, right? You work for LaunchDarkly. What do you do?
So technically my title is a developer experience engineer, but I'd say like, you know, that was a very clearly defined role when I joined about it's almost 3 years ago, where I was very much focused on creating content, specifically things to help people who were onboarding or people who were trying to kind of do different things with LaunchDarkly. I'd create deep technical guides and things like that. So I was part of like a cross-functional team, which had some docs, and had me kind of in a DevRel type role. And then it had engineers who were building like, you know, helping to improve the developer experience as a whole of LaunchDarkly. You know, things change at any company. I'm now in, I have the same title, but I'm now more like kind of traditional DevRel, where I'm, you know, I do a lot of speaking, I do a lot of writing of blog posts and other things like that. And I, you know, go build workshops, and, you know, I do all kinds of other activities that kind of you'd expect from a
DevRel. Is that by design? Did you decide to head in that direction, or is it?
No, it's just kind of changed. Yeah, it just kind of happened. I mean, there was some reorganization at the company that it was, you know, one of the key differences was before that role reported into product and this role reports into marketing. So, you know, you, I'd, having been at multiple companies and reported to different structures in within the company, it is something like, if you're looking for a DevRel role, to consider, like, where does it, it's one of the questions I always ask, where does it report into? Because that impacts the kind of goals and things, and it's just the type of goal that it is.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about developer relations and developer advocacy as a, we have this idea in our heads, right, that it's a role, a specific type of role, but you're absolutely right. Of all the people that I've spoken to on this podcast and spoken to at conferences and that type of stuff, yeah, it can be a very different job, depending on where you
definitely
are, for sure.
Yep.
Let's talk about LaunchDarkly for a minute, because it's kind of an awesome company, right? This is a company that invented feature flags, basically, right?
Well, feature flags as a service.
As a service.
Yeah. As a service, yeah. So, yeah, they did. I mean, we've been around like 10 years now. And like, I can't remember. They always quote some, we have a really large percentage of like Fortune 500 companies and all this stuff. I mean, we've, it's, you know, at this point we're established, we're like well over 500 people. Yeah. So, and you know, if you haven't used, I mean, most developers I think nowadays have used feature flags on some level, and most of them are doing some kind of like basic on off flag toggles via like, you know, a config file or some kind of remote config, right? In this case, it's this is like taking that to like the next level, where you can actually control very fine grained control over who gets to see what features. I mean, I've even built a whole entitlement systems using LaunchDarkly as kind of the, to manage all the entitlements and things like that. But I can say like, okay, I want you to be able to see this feature, but not somebody else. I want people in Ireland to be able to see this feature, but not people in other parts of the world. I mean, you can get really granular in the way that you allow people to see these features and the way you release things. And then you can even do things like run experiments to see like, okay, is this an effective feature and so on. So yeah, it's like, you know, I get a lot of developers saying like, okay, but I already have feature flags with a config. And it's like, okay, but this is a next level. Like, you're not thinking through the, like, it's hard to know all the things you can do.
Get you. Because the reason I get you is because I hand rolled something similar in a project 4 years ago. Oh man, it was painful. Wow. Yeah. Because even like, you know, the sidebar menu that most B2B SaaSes would have, even just getting the menu items correct based on the entitlements.
Exactly.
That gives you a headache. One thing that I'm interested in is, okay, I mean, you're established, you have a whole bunch of customers, but even with a Fortune 500 company, that just means that you have some teams using you, right? There's probably vast numbers, thousands of other developers in that company that are not using you guys. So there must be this continual experience of bringing feature flags and all the other stuff in into a greenfield project for the first time. Is that an important element of your developer journey in terms of onboarding?
So, I mean, it's something I focus on in terms of like the content I create and things, because it is a struggle. I think a lot of teams, you know, having talked to a lot of people, even people who've adopted LaunchDarkly, like the company has decided, but I mean, then the developers get it, and it's hard to make that transition. First of all, you know, you've been maybe using feature flags that way and it worked, right? But then it's hard to think through like, okay, why would I go about doing all these more advanced targeting things? I'm just used to like, I need it on or I need it off in this particular environment. So a lot of the content I'm creating is like about how that journey progresses. Like, how do you move from the just toggling something on and off to actually getting more advanced and doing more complex release processes and things like that, where you have like a percentage release or like some kind of targeted rollout where, you know, I'm increasing the number of people who are able to see a feature over time based on some criteria, you know, and those are things like teams it's always not always easy to adopt because it's a process change. I mean, technical changes are easy, right? Like learning new code things is easy, right? Like I could teach you how to use LaunchDarkly from an SDK standpoint. Like, okay, here's how you integrate the SDK. Yeah. Here's your call flag. That part is simple. The part that's hard, I think, for any kind of tool developers use is when you have to change how you do things, not just what kind of code goes into your project.
Yeah, I can really see that with what you guys do, because it's not, like you say, it's not just calling an API for a third-party service. You're really getting into the heart of what people are building. Do you have to bring in like client product managers, those types of people, into what you're doing? Do you produce content for them as well? Because it feels like they would be important too.
Yes, they are. I write some content that I'd say fits both a developer and a product manager audience, but I'd say largely I'm more focused on like getting developers to adopt this. Okay. You know, there are different audiences for the tools, because it does become part of the whole selling point is, hey, this becomes a whole company thing. It's not just a tool your developers use. I could hand it off to my product manager and they could manage the beta group that has beta access to certain new features. You know what I mean? Like, it's not asking a developer to do this. But that tends to kind of, you know, I sometimes write things for that, but it tends to kind of be a little bit outside the scope of my role, which is a little more technical.
Gotcha. It feels kind of scary for me as a developer to think about something like LaunchDarkly, because if I'm integrating a third-party service, I can put it in some sort of abstraction. I can contain it, and maybe I can change services later, or even something like telemetry, where there's just points in the code where I'm like, bang, here's an event. But with your stuff, you're really kind of ingrained in the logic of the application. It's a big investment. I mean, do you get resistance from developers because of that? Is that something that you're consciously trying to overcome, which is like, here are architectures that work well with feature flags?
So, I mean, I'd say there's two levels of that. One is firstly, most developers that are resistant has a lot more to do with fear of like, okay, what if you're down? What if you're slow? Kind of thing. And we have a whole like architecture that's built around like basically make sure it's cached at every level. You're not really calling out to the service. You're always checking the local cache. You're always, you know, and then we have like edge network that like basically caches all the flags around globally and all this other stuff. Like, and then they like, okay, generally I can get past that part, because they realize like there's really not, it's architected in a way to kind of prevent that. I think the thing you're talking about, like, it's not as much of a concern because they're already using flags. Actually, the thing they tend to bring up is like, how do I clean up flags? We're already using flags and it's a mess because we don't clean them up. So like that's a big concern of theirs. Yeah. But, you know, to kind of get at your concern, I've even written like things about how you wrap our SDK so that you're not really directly calling like LaunchDarkly, you're calling a wrapper of our SDK, so that it's not even just for the matter of like, hey, you could just swap things out, right? Like, it's more a way of controlling how your developers interact with us, so that you know, for instance, I don't need every developer on the team to know how to initialize the SDK client and pass the keys and stuff like that necessarily. Like, right, you shouldn't have to think about that. You just want to use a flag. So I usually will say like, okay, wrap that in some kind of wrapper that like handles the initialization and stuff for you. And then all you have to do is get your flag.
Gotcha. Yeah. It's amazing all these different layers and things that you have to think about. And we could keep going on this forever because there's the whole question of right SDKs and tons of languages, all that sort of stuff. Maybe the next time, because I also wanted to ask you about all the community building stuff that you do, Brian, which is just amazing. I don't know how you have time for all this stuff. So you have like a, I guess a an activity around something called CFE.dev, which is virtual events. And then you do in-person events as well with Orlando devs. I don't know where to start with this one. let's just go for like, a lot of people try to move to virtual events because of COVID and it didn't work out. I have run a whole bunch of meetups and I always ran in-person meetups. Ironically, post-COVID, I launched a virtual meetup, which has been quite successful. Do you think that more of our focus should be on virtual events now anyway? And the reason I ask that is I found the virtual events to be better for bringing a much wider range of people together. The in-person ones are really cool and they're so great, but they're just stuck with a particular city.
So, I mean, I think each kind of has its place. I think, you know, I hear a lot of people criticize like virtual events because, oh, you know, I don't really make real connections with other people. Right. And I don't, you know, and those things are tough, right? I think those are the areas where virtual events, like when COVID first hit, and granted, I've been running CFE.dev for 7 years, so that this was already ongoing pre-COVID. And then when COVID hit, everybody tried to like, oh, okay, we're all going to go into like virtual events. They tried to replicate in-person events virtually, which just flat out never works. Like, you know, virtual booths are not good. Let's just be honest. They're not good. They're not good for the sponsor, and they're not good for the conference. You know, and like lots of other things to try and get people to like have that same level of connection. And I'm going to be honest, having run so many of them, it's just not going to happen. Like people, you meet other people, but you just don't get that human connection you're going to get in person. There's just no way to replicate that as easily online, especially when, you know, on one-on-one, we can do it, but like, you know, in a Zoom call or something, but like having a large conference just really doesn't work that way. But it is really good at first making like content accessible to a wide range of people who often couldn't travel to conferences, whether, you know, pre-COVID, post-COVID, whatever we want to cut, like it's expensive to go to conferences. Not everybody has the budget, not where you can really get away. So like it makes content available to a wide range of people that didn't before. It's really good for Q&A actually. Like we have live Q&A all the time, and like it's hard to ask your question in person at a conference, but like it's really easy to kind of guide the conversation to answer everybody's questions virtually. You know, I think it's easy to get like a great group of speakers. I've had amazing speakers because I don't have to ask them to like fly and travel, and there's no cost. I have zero cost to the attendees. I mean, like at first we did a little bit and it's always low cost, but now I've managed to figure out a way to like make it so that the events are always free for the attendees. So that opens up, you know, a lot of options for like different people. So I think those are all things that virtual events are good. There's no way I can make a in-person event, like at least a conference, right? Free, right?
Yeah.
Meetups are a different story. So, but I also found that when I tried to run Orlando Devs virtually because everything was shut down, it didn't really work, right? Because the whole point of Orlando Devs is meeting other people here in Orlando and making connections. It's not... Yeah. It's not as much about like content as it was. The content's like an excuse for us to get together. It's not unimportant and people come to listen to it, but it's also like, you know, we're there to meet other people and locally, and it just didn't feel the same when like, you know, these people were down, you know, down the road from me basically, but here I am trying to get them together on Zoom. It never really worked. So And,
does that mean
you
if
know,
you're doing a if you're doing a virtual if you have in your mind right so this applies to me directly I'm just gonna abuse the podcast to ask you a direct question If you're running an online event, which you've styled as a meetup or in your head is like a meetup, maybe using the word meetup is the wrong word.
Yeah, I hear you.
I
still call them meetups, but I don't, because I don't know what else to call them. But
right.
But I do think, you know, it doesn't have, you don't really get to meet people in the same way you do.
No, it's much more of a learning thing, right?
Yeah, it's much more focused on the content. And so, you know, I've had people make connections via the chat or whatever, but like, I mean, they're loose, they're much looser connections than you're going to make when you meet someone in person. So it really is more focused on the content, I'd say. So yeah, the term may not be great, but I haven't come up with a better term. If you come up with one, send it my way, because I would like to.
Because it's not webinars or any of that sort of boring stuff, right? It is meant to be community stuff. Brian, my question for you on this is, you've been doing this for 7 years on the virtual side of things. So there's kind of a playbook for setting up an in-person meetup, okay? Which is get your pizza and beer sponsors, get a venue, and maybe your company provides space or whatever. And if it's in a local area, I guess it's a little bit easier to promote because you have a network and you can kind of put the word out. But how did you go about establishing an audience for virtual events? Now, what have you learned over the last 7 years? Somebody, let's say I'm a DevRel and I've been tasked to set up a virtual event.
Yeah.
How do I go about building that audience?
So I'd say it's not easy, especially if you're looking for live audience, especially now. Like, these things have changed over time. Like, I mean, I'd say like when it started, I used to promote through like newsletters and Twitter and other social, and we'd get a decent sized audience. And then during COVID that exploded and we'd get like much larger audiences. And then post COVID it's shifted to where I'd say the majority of the audience is after the fact. So I always tell my sponsors and things like, hey, the live audience is not this is not the end. Like most, when you think of a regular conference, when I show up and I give my talk and everything, that's generally speaking the end, like from our, you know, whatever benefit to us of like my talk or my sponsorship or whatever is like who I meet in person at that event. So like if the attendance is bad, the value is low, right? But like at a virtual event, it's like most of the viewership nowadays, especially, has been after the fact. I get relatively modest audiences for the live stuff. For the full day conferences, we do better. For the quote unquote meetups, we do, it's still relatively small. And then you'll get like, you can get thousands or tens of thousands of views after the fact. It's like, so, you know, it's not really, it's not about the day of. I get a lot of people who register for the event post event. Plus then I reuse the content. I'll cut the videos. Yeah. I'll do like individual session videos and I'll do like YouTube shorts and things like that to like that the content just kind of lives on after the fact. And that's usually where the actual, you know, value from like a giving the presentation goes. That's where the audience is. They're not there day of as much. So if you're going to run virtual events, just make sure that you're reusing that content, that you found a way, like kind of take the sessions, whatever's presented, you know, have them edited up, post them around, like, you know, create, there's tools, even I use an AI tool to create the shorts because it's tedious work. And, you know, so like, you know, chop them up with clips and things like that. So like, you know, you get a lot more out of it that way.
That makes a whole bunch of sense, right? Yeah. Don't freak out if only 10 people turn up or whatever, because there's going to be 1,000 people over the course of the next year. And I guess you should be planning for that, right? You're establishing the event, but you've got to see it holistically over the course of 12 months or whatever, not just the numbers on the night.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's encouraging. That is encouraging. I mean, you know, evergreen content is highly valuable, right? You could use it again and again.
Right.
Speaking about evergreen content, I wanted to, my last subject that I wanted to talk to you about was, this is for devs, we might as well get into it, Jamstack. You wrote a book on Jamstack.
Yeah, three. I mean, if you count the first one, it was like technically called a report, but yeah.
Was it worth it?
No.
I have yet to meet an author on this podcast that says yes.
So I mean, it depends on like that's another area where like things have changed quite a bit. Like publishing has changed. I'd say the report I did was great. It was easy. I did that for O'Reilly many years back now. I mean, lost track. This was before Jamstack was a term. But it was on that stuff. It was about like Jekyll and Hugo and things like that, right? And then I co-wrote a book on Jamstack with Ray Camden for O'Reilly. And that was actually, in general, a good experience. If you were doing it for the money, no, not worth it at all. If you did it because you just wanted to, like, it's something you have on your bucket list, I want to have a book. Back then, at least, working with O'Reilly, it was super, I felt like it was easy. It wasn't, like, really stressful. I mean, there was a lot of work to do, but they were really easy to work with. But I had said I wouldn't do it again just because it's hard. I mean, you have a day job, you have all these other activities you're trying to do, and then like, and you have kids and you have, you know, so
yeah.
like,
oh yeah,
fitting a book in there is, you underestimate how much time that is. And then Ray convinced me to write the second one, the Jamstack book, and I'm still holding it against him.
I hear you.
That one was really tough. The experience is different, and I'm not trying to talk bad about any particular publishers. I think just everything's changed with book publishing nowadays, so it's just not as easy an experience as it once was, because there's just not as much money in it, and they're trying to kind of find ways to make it more profitable.
It's a tough gig
and
these
it's
days.
So I've told Ray I won't do it again. I did actually write another one, but only because it was work had me do it. I had to write one. I wrote like a third of the book, or well,
but that was work, right?
Most of that, but that was work.
That was,
that's different.
You schedule like, it properly, and
exactly. I used my work day to do it, and it still was brutal, by the way. That one, in
it is always. Hey, we should just rewind for a sec. I don't know if this is necessary, but let's just define Jamstack.
how much time did you say we have?
The elevator pitch. The elevator pitch.
Oh, I think the official definition is really focused on this decoupling of the front end and the back end, right? Which is kind of the now become the core tenet of Jamstack, is that you have the back end can be made up of a whole bunch of different APIs, services, whatever. That's completely separate from the front end of the application, so that you can more easily like kind of update one without messing with the other and vice versa. So that's kind of the key piece right now. I tend to define it a lot about it, focusing a lot on the tools you use, because I feel like certain things kind of lend themselves to building with that kind of architecture, that decoupled architecture, right? So tools like Next.js and Nuxt and Astro and so on, and SvelteKit and so on. And then there's platforms like Netlify and Vercel and Cloudflare Pages that kind of support that kind of way of building applications that will automatically do things like split out server-side code into, their whatever functions that run on, like Netlify will turn into like lambdas basically in the back end. I think Vercel does the same thing, so it automatically kind of does that splitting for you. So I tend to kind of focus on my view of Jamstack is a lot around those tools, because the term kind of it got a bit ambiguous, because now it's like, oh, so server-side rendering is Jamstack and pre-rendering is Jamstack, and all the things are Jamstack. And it's like, well, so if I did my fully server-side rendered app, is that Jamstack? I mean, some people say yes.
Yeah.
Some people say no. I lean more towards the no. You know, yeah. People like Zach Leatherman, who created Levity, and they're like, he and others, like the folks at CloudCan, are kind of trying to see if they can redefine Jamstack more aligned with like the narrow definition that was the earlier version of Jamstack, which is focused more on pre-rendering, or, you know, basically static, and still supports like supporting some level of server rendering, but like mostly static, right? Mostly pre-rendered.
Yeah, I mean, definitions are, and you've written a book, right? So
yeah.
You don't have written this. The narrower the definition, the more useful it is. And this is such a problem in tech. Things kind of get fuzzy at the edges, and then they're kind of useless.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but it's kind of a natural progression of any of these. Yeah. Like I literally just gave a talk last week about buzzwords, and one of them, some of them were like, you know, just kind of talking about like buzzwords and jargon tend to start very narrow, because, well, that's, you know, we've come up with this solution, it's relatively new, and it's like we know exactly what it means. And then over time, you know, as if it's useful, it's going to gain more adoption, and people will kind of add on to it and change it. And it naturally becomes more ambiguous. And then companies say, hey, you know, this is something we want to be able to provide stuff to developers who are using this. So now we're going to start selling it and adding in, you know, you're going to end up with a term.
And you know, I think who's
every
guilty,
one of these,
the most guilty of this?
Who?
Developer advocates.
we get told to do this,
right? This is actually our fault. Oh my god, I'm just, yeah. When you think about it, right? We are our own worst enemies. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's okay in a sense. I don't sweat it, because I'm like, you know, the terms are not meaningless. And when I talk to people, like, and we talk about like what's Jamstack and what's not Jamstack, I mean, people kind of understand, and it's more like I understand that kind of things. I think of it more of an umbrella term nowadays, as a bunch of stuff underneath it. And I know if you're talking about Jamstack, it's going to talk about these things, and those things are relevant to me. Same with serverless. I mean, serverless is equally vague. It now means a whole bunch of things, but like I kind of know what it means. It doesn't have to be. We have a lot of terms under serverless and now get more granular and specific. Whereas like Jamstack, when it started, was granular and specific. Now it's an umbrella over a lot of other granular and specific terms, right? So
yeah, that's a very mature and sensible view. I started out life as a mathematician, so yeah, I want my exact definitions.
You want precision,
I'm gonna have to learn. Yeah, I'm gonna have to be learned to be more chill like you, Brian. I'm going to say goodbye. Thank you so much. Really interesting discussion about a whole bunch of different things. It's been awesome.
Yeah, this was fun. Thanks for having me.
You can find the transcript of this podcast and any links mentioned on the podcast section of our website, voxgig.com/podcast. Subscribe to the VoxGig Developer Relations Podcast on Apple, Spotify, or any podcasting platform. We publish each Tuesday and Thursday. You can also access the archive of our meetup talks on the VoxGig YouTube channel or the VoxGig website. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.